How does the temperament and personality of a city affect how Christians share their faith? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm your host, Alden Thompson. We continue our series on 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, and today we try to get close to the city itself. My conversation partners, again, are Dave Thomas, Dean of the Walla Walla University School of Theology, and Emily Flottman, member of the pastoral staff at the Walla Walla University Church. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Alden.
Thank you.
So what I would like to do is to give just a bit of background here about the city of Thessalonica. This is not giving historical information about the city. It's not the type of thing that encourages lively conversation, but a little bit of background, and then I want to raise some questions that are triggered by that city. The city itself apparently in 168 B.C. invited Rome to take over and help protect it from its enemies. Rome responded positively, though granting the city considerable freedom to continue to run its own affairs. Still, the church at Thessalonica had to learn to live in a Roman city. Though Thessalonica had more freedom than Jerusalem, for example, the Roman presence still made life more difficult for some, especially for the lower and working classes. In our discussion today, we address some of the features of city life that have a bearing on the work of the gospel. This should help us understand Paul's letters to the church at Thessalonica. Now, my first question has to do with how do believers survive in a city, in a culture that is alien to their own? Now, the biblical examples of Thessalonica and Jerusalem, you have a more overt political power. But in our age, especially in strongly Islamic cultures, you have a Christian minority. How does that affect how Christians carry on their work?
Well, I think that, you know, this is not just a question from our time. This is a question of the ages. And it's not always just Christians versus other people. I think wherever you have a religious minority, depending on the amount of freedom granted them, they have a real challenge on their hands. But since we are in a Christian context, I think we'll talk about that. I mean, for most of human history, Christianity has faced very difficult circumstances, at least outside of Western Europe. And of course, it faces those challenges in Europe now itself. And I think life for believers in a society that doesn't accept their belief is very, very challenging. And I wonder, for example, if there are any Christians in North Korea. Mm. I understand there are some. Mm-hmm. You read about people, Christians in Iran, who have to live as general citizens without, you know, trying to make sure they don't distinguish themselves, and they practice their religion and their devotional exercise at home in the evenings. You can look at the whole of life under the communist regime. We have a colleague here at Walla Walla University who grew up under communism and actually spent some time one afternoon as a young man in prison. I've known friends who have been beaten because of this dynamic. And I guess depending on the degree of latitude given you, you can either be public or you have to be private. And sometimes you simply have to be underground. Mm-hmm. You have to have no public presence.
Well, the idea of separation of church and state, which is so important in American culture, actually was driven not by religious people initially, although, you know, Seventh-day Adventists and certain branches of the Baptist community have contributed to that. But if you go to Europe, for example, even during the era of the Reformation, there wasn't anything like religious freedom. For instance, when the Reformation came, you had to choose whether you wanted to be in a Reformation country or in a Catholic country. And you didn't have that right. You had to move. If you were, and so this idea of an alien culture, Paul has some really interesting challenges as he tries to go in, working with the Jews on the one hand and the Romans on the other, and it's something that we need to ponder how you can best work as a Christian witness.
Well, Alden, you know, you raise an interesting question because I've been kind of following this debate that's current right now involving healthcare and requiring insurance carriers to provide certain medical services, particularly having to do with reproduction or the prevention thereof. and there is no exclusion for religious conscience. And mm-hmm. if you look at some of the blogs on that, it's astonishing to see how many people think that freedom of conscience is too expensive. Mm-hmm. That I read some blogs this week that I found quite chilling, mm-hmm. saying that the government has a right to tell everybody this is a humanitarian thing that the government is doing, and it allows for equal treatment of all people, and so no church, and of course the Catholic Church is the one primarily involved in this debate because they don't want to participate in this because of deeply held theological and convictions of conscience that a lot of people are suggesting we have no responsibility to respect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I find myself astonished that our experiment in religious liberty appears to me to be eroding enormously. We do not have a societal sense of conscience anymore. Mm-hmm. The government can require us. And, you know, it raises a very interesting question. What if the government began to require something that was overtly Christian? Mm. See?
And there are Christian forces who would love to see that happen.
That's true. And I don't support those at all. But, you know, the fact that the government is doing something that you happen to like should not be understood as a mandate that must be applied to everybody, because one day the government might change its mind. Mm-hmm. And we have a long history of respecting issues of conscience. And to suggest that in the Roman Catholic community issues of reproduction are not issues of conscience, in my opinion, is nonsense. Mm-hmm. That's a deeply seated, a theologically established idea that should be protected. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let's go on to another question now that has effect on Christian witness, and that is urban versus rural. Now, there, if you look at the way religious communities operate, there are those who adapt to culture and those who avoid culture. This is classic sectarian formation. Christians in their early formation were sectarian. They were countercultural. My own community, Seventh-day Adventist, was strongly countercultural in its origins. You could probably say the same thing about Jehovah's Witnesses and the Amish. These are strongly countercultural. But if you are strongly countercultural, how does that affect your ability to witness to those who are different?
I think this is a really good question. And I think in my faith community, this is a big struggle, even in my own life, of loving to be out in the country, and there's this being in the world and not of it verse in Scripture. But the idea of being in the country and pulling away and what that provides is very attractive to me. But I also have a heart for people, and people are in the cities; they're in the urban areas, and so I do believe God calls people to work in those areas, to live in those areas, to be a part of those communities. It's hard to witness to people that you're not a part of their community. And so I do believe that our mission is also in the cities.
And, you know, this is an interesting shift, because if you go back to 1900, the percentage of the Earth's population that were rural and agrarian was way, way higher mm-hmm. when compared mm-hmm. to urban ones. But, of course, there's been a massive shift, and in the last 20 years it's been very pronounced, mm-hmm. the shift away from agrarian places to urban places, largely because of the availability of jobs that have cash and so forth. And so mm-hmm. I think this becomes a huge issue. I'm not somebody who's familiar with cities. I don't really like cities. But Emily's point is sustained, that if you want to find people today, they're not in the rural areas. They're in the cities.
Mm-hmm. And I think we think of mission work a lot as going to another country when we have cities that are great mission fields right in our backyard. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they're tough places to work, because mm-hmm. people are so insulated from each other. They live in apartment houses and this kind of stuff, and everybody lives their own little life, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yet there are mixing impulses there in the city, which you don't find in the country. It's much easier to maintain your purity of whatever you are if you're away from other people.
Yeah.
That's true.
And by the way, sometimes that separation is an instrument of mission, that mm-hmm. people see that as very attractive. But, of course, that depends on circumstance too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. good. Now, in that connection, there is one method that works mostly in cities, that you find evidence for this in the New Testament, and that is the house church. You don't build a church building, but you meet with people in homes. As I say, a number of the churches that Paul established, a number of the communities had these kinds of house churches. Would that work more and better if we tried that with greater enthusiasm today?
I don't know if it would work more or better, but I certainly am a fan of this method in cities, especially in very unchurched areas where it may be uncomfortable for someone to come into a church building. But boy, it's way more inviting for the fellowship in a home. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there are places where this is very effective. And I love this method because it creates fellowship and relationship. And I think people always are more grounded, in my opinion, in church when they also have relationship.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also it's financially efficient. You know, mm-hmm. you're not having to build a $2-4 million building, which is not hard to do today.
And is empty 6 days out of the week.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And but I think the challenge of house churches is that aside from being missional in a very local fellowship sense, they don't have much of a capacity to affect areas beyond themselves. And mm-hmm. so the collaboration between home churches in terms of mission becomes a challenge. But I think that this may be an idea that whose time has come again. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've known quite a number of churches that began as house churches and then grew. And perhaps in a city where getting buildings is almost impossible, mm-hmm. a house church is a great idea.
There is a psychological benefit, however, from having a larger group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if all you see, I remember when we were in Scotland, there was a little church. It wasn't a house church, but it was in a tiny little upstairs chapel. The pews would sit three people, you know, if you really squeezed. Yeah. Cute would be the right word to use there. But there were seven first-generation Christians there, and that was all. See, and I remember once a choir from La Sierra University was on tour. And this was in Edinburgh, where the Seventh-day Adventist Church was larger. It had 40, 50 members. And here you had a choir, 50 voices, something mm-hmm. like that. They came in and sang in the church, and these people thought they'd died and gone to heaven.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because, wow, there are this many people, you know, who believe like we do. And that was really very crucial. Now, one other thing we can just tag on here very quickly. What about dealing with other church groups that don't have the same convictions?
Mm.
I'm thinking here of Rob Bell, mm-hmm. who has articulated a position on what happens when you die that's very close to what Adventists mm-hmm. do. Mm-hmm. Should we be able to work with people like that?
Well, I think in a broad sense, all Christians should be working together where they can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think that in working with other Christians, we learn from them as well while
Absolutely.
Maintaining our own.
Yep. Good. Mm-hmm. Well, our time is up. Next week, we're going to talk about joyous and thankful. We're going to actually dive into 1 and 2 Thessalonians itself. My thanks to Dave and Emily for helping, and my thanks to Chad Ofterhauer, our program engineer, to all of you for listening in. For A Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.